Good morning, Te Tirangi Baptist Church, TBC. Just as I've been reflecting on what Blake has been saying this morning, I was reminded of just before we got the position here to come to Te Tirangi, and God had sort of shown me sort of a cup of suffering or of hands raised up. And I felt God was saying that this would be, it would be tough ministering here, taking this position. And I said yes to God, that yes, I would like to choose this. I would like to honour you in taking this position. And it has been an eventful few weeks, few months. Us coming up to here, a new place. We had the Christchurch attacks, throwing things up a little bit around in the air. We had Easter camp. Christelle and I have been away for a couple of weeks, 2 weeks, sharing about our mission plans in the North Island. And Andy's just gone away. So there's been a lot which has been going on. In some ways it has been quite tough with a bit of pressure. It's great to be here, and Christelle and I just want to love and serve you. We choose this, and it's great to worship Jesus together. Okay, so this morning we're heading towards Daniel 5, and in this chapter, there's a phrase that is sometimes used in society, and it's used in the 2015 James Bond movie, Spectre. It's also used by the US OK Go band, and they're famous for their colourful music videos. I'm not sure if you've heard of them, but do you know what the phrase might be? So,
YOLO.
No, but cool. Any other guesses out there? Okay, well, the writing is on the wall. The writing's on the wall. So from Daniel chapter 5, which comes from a few thousand years ago, this phrase has come into our culture today, and the internet tells us that the phrase comes, that we use this phrase when an inevitable result or imminent danger has become apparent. So we're going to learn a little bit about that this morning. But also, first, let me acknowledge that in coming to this Daniel series, I've originally come with a bit of apprehension. These guys, Daniel and his friends, they seem to get the perfect university grades at the Babylonian, under the Babylonian king. They did these great things for God, and they just seemed so holy. So, you know, I was sitting there reading, and it's like, oh, this is a bit intimidating, these Daniel and his friends, these great guys who did great things for God. But then one home group, when I was sitting in with a group, Marissa started sharing about how she was inspired by Daniel and saw God's greatness through him. And I was like, yeah, that's cool. And then a few weeks ago, when Caleb shared on his chapter in the Blueprint service, and sharing about the greatness of what God did through Daniel, I was like, yeah, that's really, really cool. So I'm really excited to be here this morning to share about the book of Daniel. And I don't think that he was this pie-in-the-sky kind of guy. I don't think that he thought of himself as superior to anyone else. We see in Daniel 5 and the book of Daniel that he was a humble kind of guy, a person who was reliant on God. So this morning we're looking at the picture of the Fowl Feast as part of our Captured by a Better Vision series. And as we look to this chapter this morning, I hope that you will be encouraged to live with a humble and a holy passion for God. It's my prayer that you'll be inspired by God's greatness that stands above countries and rulers that refuse to give him praise, like New Zealand maybe. And it's my confidence that by faith that you will be strengthened to honour God, the God who gives us every good thing and holds our lives in his hands. Right, so let's get into this. Verse 1, King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for thousands of his nobles and drank with them. Okay, so this sets the scene. Verse 1 sets the scene of this great feast. And what kind of feast was it? Well, it was a big feast. Did you notice that there are 1,000 nobles at Belshazzar's banquet? So it wasn't just a casual New Zealand backyard barbecue we've got going on here. This was a big feast. And it wasn't just a random crowd of people. It was Babylon's most powerful and political players all gathered together. So there would have been a little bit of expectation sitting on Belshazzar's shoulders, which, being the king, maybe he could handle. But these kinds of feasts were put on to try and win the political support of these bigwigs, these nobles that had come to the party. And if you're wondering why the nobles would want to come to these kinds of parties, well, they had a bit of an agenda too. It was to try and work their way up the ladder of power. So they came to network. So anyway, you can imagine Belshazzar after a few sips of wine, maybe a glass or two, when things are starting to get going a little bit. And maybe there's a little bit of a lull. And he looks around and he thinks, how can I get this party really going? How can I impress these people? You know, a little bit like when people start egging each other on at a party to do crazy things, to cross that next boundary, like stealing supermarket trolleys or burning couches on the street. Or maybe just following other people and joining in with their gossip or laughing at rude things. So the next thing we see Belshazzar deciding to do is to do something with a bit of an edge, something that maybe he thinks will get this party rocking to the next level. So let's see what he does from verse 2. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. And so you can see what Belshazzar does. He goes and takes the sacred articles from Israel's temple. He takes what belonged to Yahweh, the people of God. In appealing to the masses, Belshazzar goes the whole nine yards with them, praising the gods of silver and of gold, and not only of these, but all kinds of material things that they can think of wood, stone, bronze, and iron. They worship all kinds of gods, but the one true God, and sticking it right into his face. Now, if you compared this situation to modern standards, it might look like a kind of rocking party, similar to music videos that you see on MTV. Belshazzar has all the cool cats and big wigs of the empire. He's surrounded by the woman, his wives and concubines, as we saw in verses 2 and 3. And in the middle of the party, he pulls out the big guns. He gets the gold and silver goblets from his treasury. But things were about to change. God was going to tip this party upside down. Fatal news was coming for Belshazzar. his time was coming to an end. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall. Belshazzar doesn't know what's going on at this point, so he keeps watching as this hand keeps writing. His face turns pale, and he becomes so frightened that his legs become weak and start knocking. Now, this would be pretty freaky, having this hand appearing in front of you like a ghost and writing something on the wall. But as we look through the text, we see that other people don't seem to be quite as affected as Belshazzar. His nobles are only baffled in verse 9, and the queen comes in with a bit more confidence a bit later on. But Belshazzar, he was shaking, because he knew that this message was for him. What other kind of news could have had this kind of effect, do you think? The news that an army was coming? But even then, a king would have plans and strategies in place for what to do at that time. So here, Belshazzar was totally unprepared, and he didn't know what was going on. So here's Belshazzar, this big wig, great king, in the middle of his party, at his palace. He's surrounded with 1,000 of the most influential people, and yet he's shaking in his boots. Like so many people today, Belshazzar seemed to have it all sorted on the outside, but on the inside, he had problems of security. He hadn't built a secure foundation of a life of love and honor towards God, though he could have. And it's kind of ironic that it only takes the smallest touch from our big God, an appearance of his hand, to set Belshazzar off the balance. So Belshazzar is starting to get rattled, and he does what we would do when we start to get rattled and turning to the things that we are most used to trusting in. So he turns to his enchanters, astrologers, and diviners, but none of these can help. And so in Belshazzar's greatest time, he's left high and dry, even after he tries and throws all his money at the problem. You know, somehow he thinks that if he throws enough resource at this problem, it'll go away. So he calls his wise men and tells them in verse 7, "Whoever reads the writing and tells him what it means would be clothed in purple, have a gold chain around his neck, and made the third highest ruler of the kingdom." So Belshazzar was all about the bling. He's all about the gold chain, the threads, got some here, and the position. But none of these are able to help him in his time of need. And so how easy it is for us to get distracted from God and to focus on material things, the things that our world idolizes. It's easy for us to be captivated by the material world and the comforts that it brings, that we can struggle to see anything more. We can dream of that idyllic holiday, of buying the next thing for our house, or what's in our neighbor's house, their latest insulation. But in the meantime, we can start struggling to see this God who is above all things. We can start struggling to see this God who is loving. We can struggle to see the point of prayer, struggle to prioritize church. And the list goes on. So when things start to fall apart, it starts becoming quickly clear what we have put our trust in. So what are we putting our trust in this morning? And is it going to stand the test when disaster strikes? And who do you go to when you need a bit of advice? Do you have strong Christians around you? Do you have strong relationships with other Christians? Are you involved with home groups? Because these are the people who we can turn to. These are the people who Jesus has entrusted the words of life, the keys of the kingdom, as he explains in Matthew 16, verse 19. They're the kind of people to have around you to help us keep heading in the right direction. Now, atheism. Let me speak to this philosophy for a moment. It's a very subtle philosophy, but it's all around us. And it's an idolatrous philosophy which seeks to take our worship and knowledge of God. Atheism is basically a philosophy against God's knowledge. A for against, and theism for the knowledge of God. So essentially, against the knowledge of God. Atheism is a default kind of position that we find ourselves in as sinful human beings. It's a mindset that we once lived by, that still surrounds us and tempts us. And when troubles come our way, when we become a bit isolated, when our walk starts getting a bit dry, these kinds of arguments can start slipping into our hearts. Like, how can a loving God exist and let pain and suffering be in my life or in the life of others? At the time, these arguments can seem so right and so smooth as they seek to help us get rid of God and just enjoy the moment. They push us to be like Belshazzar, giving ourselves to meaningless things, to unrestricted pursuits and enjoyment of material things, well, so far as our money and power allow us to enjoy, and so far as the bad consequences don't significantly start infringing upon us. But what can these kind of philosophies offer us? When we consider the bigger picture, when we consider the grave, we find that these kinds of philosophies are just a smokescreen of arguments against a God who supposedly does not exist. Go figure. When we compare these kinds of arguments and thoughts to the depths of God's glory and his goodness, we know there is no comparison. That God is the God of all things who stands above the earth, the giver of life. So Belshazzar had put his trust in all the wrong places. His position in the material things of life, in the pleasures of women, and of drunken disobedience to God. Things weren't going to go well for him. In our next scene, the queen comes in into the king's palace, calm and collected. She has a bit of hope, and she thinks that she tells the king that there is someone who can answer his questions and solve the riddle. And so Daniel is brought into the scene, and he's offered the threads, the bling, and the position as a reward. But he's not seeking these things, and so he tells the king, "Yeah, I'll give you this advice for free." Going on to explain the situation in verse 18, he says, "Your Majesty, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all the peoples of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from the people and given a mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like the ox. And his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over all kingdoms of the earth and sets over them anyone he wishes. But you, Belshazzar, his son, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives, and your concubines drunk from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. Therefore, he sent the hand that wrote the inscription. This is the inscription that was written. Mene, mene, tekel, parson. Here is what the words mean. Mene, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. So the writing is on the wall. Belshazzar's reign is coming to an end. That very night he was killed and his kingdom was given to others. Daniel, on the other hand, is clothed in purple, given the gold chain, and proclaimed the third highest ruler of the kingdom. So why was Belshazzar's reign brought to an end? Because he had known about God, the God who had shown his father Nebuchadnezzar, who was the greatest ruler of the greatest empire of that time, that he, Yahweh, was the Most High God, that he, Yahweh, was the God who ruled over the kings, giving them their kingdoms and all kinds of power and authority. But Belshazzar had not humbled himself or given honor to God, as in verses 22 and 23. And what a big thing it is for God to give power to people and to a pagan, to entrust great kingdoms to Nebuchadnezzar and to Belshazzar, to give so much power and control to a person and to people. And yet this is exactly what God had done and what God has done, entrusting kingdoms to people and to us. And God had revealed his glory to the Babylonians, to Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar's father, showing him his kindness, his goodness, and in great vulnerability. Yet Belshazzar had gone his own way and continued to go his own way, sticking it to God's face. He'd gone and taken the articles from the most holy place of Yahweh's people Israel and used them to drink and worship gods of silver and gold. So although we see that God's witness through the nation of Israel had been demolished, we also see that he was firmly in control. God's hand was still firmly over the happenings of the earth, and he was wanting to be known by people. You see, it's no coincidence that while Israel was at their weakest point in history, that God was showing himself to be far above the greatest ruler of that time, Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, in chapters 4 and chapters 5. But whereas chapter 4 had ended on this high note of Nebuchadnezzar having come to worship and honor God, to know and love him, chapter 5 ends on this low note of Belshazzar having failed to humble himself before God and give him glory. His rule is finished and his kingdom is given to other people. People of Titirangi, God is after our surrender, our love and our affection. He desires our humbled hearts. He got Nebuchadnezzar's, but he didn't get Belshazzar's, and it didn't end well for him. God wants you. We can't just excuse ourselves saying, "Oh, I'm not that important. Don't worry about me. I'll just hide in the background." Because God cares about you. He wants you. And you. and you. So it's no good just knowing about God, this God that our parents or grandparents knew. We must respond to God. Humbling ourselves and honoring him. The onus is on us. Notice that Belshazzar was supposed to have humbled himself in verse 22. This humbling is not just going to happen by itself. No one can do it for us. We have to respond to God by humbling ourselves before him. And how we can do this post-Jesus is through baptism and a life of following his teachings. There is no greater or no lesser act of humility that God requires of us than to be baptized and follow Jesus' teachings. And as we come to know God, journeying with him through Christ, we live this life of a continued response to God's goodness, his greatness, and his kindness by living humbly before him, by giving him the honor and glory that is due his name. Like Daniel. Daniel wasn't one of the bigwigs in our story. He wasn't near the king's table at the banquet. He wasn't even one of the nobles, even though he had shown himself previously to be one of the most able rulers of the king's men. To get Daniel, they had to go out and find him, to search him and get him, to bring him in. Daniel had been almost entirely forgotten. But those who honour God, God will honour. Like that plaque in 32 Cowrie Lins Road. It's obviously been there for some time, but its message rings true. 1 Samuel 2 verse 30. Those who honour me, I will honour. This honour doesn't always come straight away, maybe not even in this life. But those who honour God will be honoured by him. Daniel was honoured by God in our story. But what he was chasing after was not what he could get in this life. Daniel was looking towards the eternal kingdom that God will graciously and generously give to those who love and serve him. Is that what we want? Is that what we're chasing after? The honour that comes from God. So Daniel, he's recorded in this book, chapter 5, book of Daniel, chapter 5, not for receiving these gold threads in the chain and position. Daniel is recorded for his faithful service, for following and obeying God. Daniel is known for the great wisdom and insight that he shared, that he had come to God and whom he had given glory for his humble service to God in the face of difficulties. And for these things, Daniel's name will forever be in God's hall of fame. And if we can find contentment in God, like Daniel, without the big chain, without the purple cloth and great position, like Daniel, we will be able to be content in seasons of plenty and when these things come. Daniel didn't set his heart after the gold chain, the purple cloth, or the position. But when he found himself with them, he was able to humbly receive them, knowing that his identity and well-being were not tied up in them. He knew that he had a more stable foundation, treasures in God's eternal house to look towards. So that is our call this morning, to humble ourselves before God, giving him the glory and honour that is due his name, through baptism and a life of following his ways, through a lifestyle like Daniel, a lifestyle that comes with a promise of God's presence, his favour and his peace, and of great honour one day. But the writing is on the wall. The kingdoms of this world, like Belshazzar's, are coming to an end. The idols of the material world cannot save us. Ignorance is no cure. Christ is our only hope. Christ is the one who can give us true life. He is, after all, creator of everything, even the things that we are tempted to worship. Only His is the kingdom of righteousness, peace, and joy. His is the kingdom that will last forever. Power and life are in His hands. And so as I entrust you to Him today, to the God who holds our lives lovingly in His hands, let me leave us thinking with these two questions of how we can humbly and courageously serve Jesus this week. How can we bring honor and glory that is due to His name?